You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode number 21 and I am your host, Thomas Smith. I've got a great guest for you today. His name is Michael Marshall. You might know him as Marsh. He hosts the show Be Reasonable, among other things, and you're going to hear all about that, what his show is. It's particularly relevant given the price discussion of a week back. And, well, you'll see. It's a great discussion. I wanted to have him on to talk about the tactics of talking to people who are just coming from a vastly different place, which is what he does over on Be Reasonable. And I hope you'll forgive it for being a little meta. I mean, this is a pretty meta discussion, in addition to getting into his past and his podcast, which is, of course, fascinating, and you should check it out. It's also a meta discussion on what we're doing here, what we should be doing in light of this political situation, and talking to people that really, really come from a different world in a way. So I hope you like it. I loved it. I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks to Marsh for coming on. And without further ado, here you go. Joining me right now is Michael Marshall, goes by Marsh sometimes. So Marsh, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Thomas. How about yourself? You good?
I am doing great. You know, I'm really glad to be talking to you because I think you messaged me after the Price interview, right? And it was like, yeah, hey, I've been doing this kind of thing for quite a while. And I thought, why don't we talk about this? I can't believe we haven't talked about this sooner. But before we get to all that, I wonder, for anyone who's not familiar with your work, if you want to talk about Be Reasonable a little bit and kind of the other things, projects you do.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I co-founded the Merseyside Skeptic Society back in 2009. And when we set that up, we kind of started a few different things going at once. We kind of ran a local event, the Skeptics in the Pub. We started doing things like fairly large-scale activist campaigns. So I ran we came up with the 1023 overdose campaign where we had people all around the world taking overdoses of homeopathic medicine to demonstrate
I heard about that.
Yeah, that was a nuts. What's really weird about that?
How many people died? Well, there must have been casualties.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Well, fortunately, all these many years later, we haven't met anybody who died as a result of it yet. But
we're speaking with terrorist Michael Marshall. There's just thousands of bodies. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, it's nuts. We had like 1,700 people around the world taking part in that event, and it was run by myself and two friends of mine at the MSN.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Front page news of the BBC less than a year after we started the Skeptic Society at all, which was kind of ludicrous, really, at the time. So we started a podcast there called Skeptics with a K, and I've been an activist in skeptical stuff for years. I'm now a full-time skeptical activist and investigator for a charity. And the thing that kind of most fits, I suppose, is Be Reasonable, this weird semi-art project show that I have where I have conversations with people who are wrong on lots of different issues, in my opinion. And we try and just explore the gap in between our thinking and to have about as civil a debate as we can achieve, with the starting point being that we fundamentally disagree. You know, I'm not there to shout at them and berate them and tell them they're idiots and wrong and morons or anything like that. I'm just there to try and get what they're about and try and take them through their own views to see if I can kind of, as a lens, reflect back to them the logic of their thinking and see whether that takes them anywhere they've not been before. So it's a slightly unusual show, really.
Yeah. Well, okay. That was going to be the first thing I was going to ask you. So what is your goal when you're doing this? And, well, actually, why don't you tell me, how did you have this idea? Because this show goes back quite a while, right? When did you first think of doing this?
Well, it actually goes back to a show I did, Righteous Indignation, was just a kind of a weekly skeptical show we did. And we used to do interviews on there. But we found, because I was hosting it with two people who were former believers who'd kind of come to the skeptical world having been ghost hunters and crop circle believers and all sorts of things like that, we found that while shows, the skeptical shows that were around at the time were doing interviews, they were all interviewing the names in skepticism and people who are doing this project or running that. And we thought, well, we could do that as well, but we're not going to get something out of them that someone else probably hasn't already got. But because my co-hosts had this background of being around believers, we started to just introduce, these interviews of people who were on the other side. So I think we interviewed a psychic by the name of Patricia Putt, who'd failed $1 million challenge, I think, back in, 2009, something like that. And we had a conversation with her, and it kind of escalated from there, really. And it just, so when we stopped that show, just because doing a weekly show with a million other things that we were doing was just a bit too much for us to all take after a couple of years. The bit that I really wanted to keep alive was this segment where we talked to someone we disagreed with, because it just didn't seem like it was out there anywhere else, really, where we're actually engaging with people we disagree with. I mean, I'm a big proponent of the idea that for us to be the best logical thinkers, the best critical thinkers, the best skeptical thinkers we can be, we need to understand what it is that we're disagreeing with in the first place. And that might mean going to a psychic show. It might mean going to a mind, body, spirit festival. It might mean going to a homeopathic consultation and see what kind of things they actually say. And it definitely means talking to people who believe in this stuff to understand what is the rhetoric that got them there? What is the evidence that got them there? And how coherently do they consider that evidence? How coherently do they put their point of view together? And what's convincing to them?
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. So that's kind of something that I wanted to look at, like, because I've been really struggling lately, just in my own mind, thinking about like what can we even do? I mean, with the climate as it is in the U.S. right now, I mean, the Trump election was just such a blow, and it was it's just, I never before have I felt, I mean, there's always been right and left and political disagreements, of course, but like never before have I felt like, okay, there is half of the country, or at least half of the voting population ish, who I just, you can't even speak to. They're just in a different world. Like, their version of facts, or maybe I'm in a different world, you know, like one of us is not in, one of us is in a different world from the other. And it's like, you can't even talk about it. And I just got so tired of, especially after, it might've been different if Hillary had won the election, I might've just gone on my merry way. And I'll say for my part, by the way, I have tried to have people I disagree with on the show. That's actually always been one of my goals as well. Not exclusively, like Be Reasonable is. It's never been the exclusive goal of it, but I do want to be a place where we explore different views. And, I've had pro-lifers on. I've had whatever it is. I do enjoy that quite a bit. But I would say, I'm scrambling around here a bit because there's like two different things I want to ask you, and I'm deciding like which one. But I wanted to know... and it sounds like you already answered earlier, but the biggest barrier for me is actually finding people willing to talk. You talked about, you had associates who had a history of, with these kind of people and ghost hunters and that kind of thing. Is that your main source of being able to get people on your show? Because I cannot tell you how many times on Twitter, on Facebook, whatever it is, where someone is, you know, telling me all these reasons why I'm wrong on something, and I say, let's talk, let's Skype right now. I will let you talk as much as you want. We can Skype. It's got to be at least like a dozen times I've tried to do that. Never works. It never works. I mean, maybe I'm going about it the wrong way, but where is your source of all these people where you're able to be like, hey, you're nuts, come on my show.
Weirdly, I don't seem to have too much of an issue finding people. I mean, I the show was actually on hiatus for about 8 months of last year, partly because I didn't have the time to go and find people when I had a million other things kind of going on. But other than that, we tend to have a fairly, I say we, it's just me on the show now, but the show tends to have a fairly good record of getting people on. I don't tend to struggle to find people. And I think partly it's because of the approach. The show doesn't argue with people on Twitter.
Right.
I mean, I personally will. And occasionally I'll say, you know what, fine, let's have this discussion. And people in that situation will often turn me down if I've been arguing with them on Twitter or pointing out the flaws in their logic. I mean, I've been arguing with a homeopath by the name of Dana Ullman, who you might have seen around for a number of years now. He comes out the woodwork, says something incredibly dumb, and then sort of buggers off before you have a chance to really sort of test him on it or approach him on it. And I'd love to have him on the show, but I don't think he ever will because he knows that I disagree with him fairly vehemently. But the people that I get on, I mean, I tend just to send them an email, to the whatever web form or email address I have to them and just say, I do this show, I disagree with you, but I want to explore these issues.
Okay, so that was going to be my other question. So you're totally open about it. They know what they're getting into. They know the fact that it's, you know, you disagree, but you're still able to get them on.
Yeah, but I think fundamentally for the show to work, I have to be honest at every point.
Yeah.
You know, I can't have any level of disingenuity about it because that kind of undermines what the show's about. It also gives me a technical backstop too because I can't edit the show. Because I'd never want the guest to be able to say, oh, well, I answered that question much better, but you've cut the answer down or you've manipulated the audio in this way to take out this really good answer that I gave. So I say, look, it's going to be an unedited conversation, so I'm not going to skew it. You can see the back catalogue I've had of conversations. I want to give you a chance to explain to me why I disagree with you. Explain to me why you see it one way and I can't see it that way. You know, get me over that hurdle to agree with you. And sometimes you get people on who are incredibly kind-hearted and utterly sincere, genuinely believe that whatever belief that they hold is correct, and they're kind of looking for truth. There's a chap I had on recently called Lee Piercy, who was a ghost hunter.
Yeah, I caught that one.
Really. Yeah, such a warm, lovely kind of fella.
Yeah.
I think his understanding of quantum physics is deeply flawed.
Well, his understanding of physics is... I loved when he talked about sound particles or something. It was he was talking about how sound particles couldn't get through something, and you're explaining, well, no, it's actually they're waves. But you also, on the spot, you had such a good analogy. That was really cool. So it's cool to find out that you don't edit. I didn't realize because you just on the spot, you're just like, oh, here's an analogy. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, sometimes it comes off well. Sometimes it's terrible. Sometimes I don't have anything to go to and you can hear me floundering, or you'll hear me say, oh, that's interesting. And my that's interesting is the holding space that I use verbally while I'm trying to process what they said, find the counterexample, and then feed that counterexample back through a filter so it doesn't come across as aggressive or dickish or confrontational or kind of, on a high horse. But I think I it's a verbal tic that I have in those conversations because I'm desperately trying to avoid anything that sounds like I'm agreeing with them or endorsing a point of view that I disagree with. And it's quite hard in that kind of a social situation where you want the conversation to carry on flowing naturally, to not agree with something you totally disagree with. So yeah, it's normally me going, oh, that's interesting, or something like that. But the counterexamples, when you do get one on the spot, then it is as an interviewer or an interlocutor, it's an incredibly satisfying moment that you feel like you've actually done something fairly well, but they don't always come in that way.
Yeah, so that's interesting you talk about not ever agreeing with them or at least looking or peering as though you agree with them. And that was something I was going to ask you about as well, because it was interesting. I listened to the last couple, and the flat earth guy, that was one that I think was – that must have been a challenge because he threw so much at you so fast that I just don't feel like – you had a whole lot of time to refute much of it. You know, is there a fine line between, I guess, being like too willing to be nice and to be calm and rational and let the person talk and just not getting a chance to really question any of these points because it's just too much? I mean, he's just splattering all these things at you. Oh, this guy in Antarctica, blah, this satellite, blah, just all this stuff that you would really be hard-pressed to respond to all of it. What's the line you walk there?
Well, I think what I always try to do is keep the conversation going as it is, basically. So you'll get some people who will throw out a huge amount of information, not all of which will check out. But I trust my audience that if somebody is doing that, is trying to sort of, in a sense, sort of railroad the conversation by overloading me with facts, you know, gish galloping past me, then the audience will hear that. And I don't need to go through and categorically go back and say, well, this was wrong, that was wrong, that was wrong. Because I think that tactic can be quite obvious to the audience. So it's knowing that there are details in there that you can pick out and go, okay, you've said 20 different things. Let's examine one of them. Here's why this doesn't stand up. It's trusting that the audience won't then go, well, that one was wrong, but the other 19 were right.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite useful for the context of the conversation. And it's an argument that or a discussion that I've had with people about the show in the past, because I'd have the worst, most abhorrent views on the show if I could. And in fact, I had a guy who was an AIDS denialist naturopath from India who was viciously anti-Semitic and deeply homophobic in the conversation. Was talking about how AIDS isn't caused by a virus because viruses are too small to affect the human body. AIDS is caused by pieces of feces going down the opening in your penis when you have anal sex, and that dirtiness is what's causing AIDS. Now, in that situation, I'm hearing absolutely abhorrent stuff, and people might say, well, why would you give that a platform? But I think the context of the show being this is an exploration of fringe ideas, not all of which are going to be palatable, but all of which I promise are worth hearing, gives me the space to give a platform to people. Yeah. That I think in other spaces, you know, I wouldn't have wanted that chap Leo Rebello to be interviewed by the BBC News.
Right,
I'm quite
right.
happy for him to be interviewed by me, and that would be similar with, you know, anti-vaccination advocates, things like that. So. When it comes to someone who's doing that gish galloping, I like to think that my audience will hear that and go, okay, well, that's what's happening there. There's a gish gallop, and they know that I don't need to counter every one of those. Maybe I just need to find a few things here and there that skewer his point of view slightly. And I think I did that when he was talking about being a conspiracy theorist who believed in all the conspiracies before he became a flat earther. And then I said, well, now that you're a flat earther, are there any conspiracy theories you no longer believe in?
Just said, the well, one I that was incompatible with flat earth. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The one I don't believe there's a face on Mars. It's like, yes, because you don't believe Mars exists. Yeah. that's not a regression back to reality. Yeah. That's a step into the beyond. So I think those kinds of things can be quite useful. But it does mean that I end up in positions where, I mean, I interviewed Jim Humble, who was the founder of Miracle Mineral Solution, the industrial bleach that quacks give to autistic children and people with Crohn's disease as a cure. And I had him on I mean, this was back when it was Righteous Indignation. We had him for about an hour and a half, something like that. And that was at a time when he wasn't speaking to the BBC and he wasn't returning the Guardian's calls. But I said, I'd like to have a conversation with you where we'll be polite and good-natured and explore the difference in our opinions. And he said yes, and we ended up calling him in, I think it was in Guatemala or Nicaragua, where he's still giving this incredibly dangerous thing to people who've got terminal diseases. The only time in my life I've ever been on a phone call with someone that I, midway through the conversation, became very aware that he's probably responsible for the deaths of thousands of people.
Wow.
But I think that makes the show useful, you know, to hear his point of view, hear how he actually justifies himself.
So selfishly, you know, when I've listened to your show and when we've talked a little bit already, I've been imagining what I can apply to my show, you know, because what I've been trying to do, I've been kind of public about it, is I'm trying to figure out just what to do, as I started to say earlier, in this situation. Like, because there are a lot of people who and I'll bring it back to U.S. politics. Sorry, it's just what started all this, I guess, for me. Is there any use to interviewing a Trump supporter? That's something. And actually, a lot of people have said, just don't even interact with them. There's no point. Like it. And I'm really trying to find the answer to that. I'm trying to find whether or not it's worthwhile. And I think the key difference, maybe, between what you and I are doing is, as you've already stated, your show has a specific theme. Like, you, people know what it is. People know that the people they're hearing are people with alternative views, because I would not want to bring one of those people on my show, like say the AIDS guy or the bleach guy. I would not want to bring them on my show unless I'm just going to outright challenge them at every point that I can, because I just don't. It's too much of a risk
of challenging him on every point.
I would say on the most egregious points, like the things I didn't mean to say every point, but what I would do, I think it may be a difference in how we would approach it, is if someone's gish galloping or whatever, I would want to try to slow them down and just take, and if not, let them go and then try to answer every point. Instead of doing that, stop them after a point and say, let's talk about this one point first before moving on to a lot of other stuff. But when you say your audience will know what's going on. So one of my questions was going to be, who is your target audience? And it sounds like your target audience is skeptics. It sounds like you're having people who you know aren't skeptical to talk to a bunch of skeptics. And I wonder, do you know that is what your audience is? Do you ever think, hey, there's going to be some, you know, non-skeptical people listening to this for other purposes?
Well, I think there may be people who aren't self-identified skeptics listening to it at that point. I mean, I never thought that would be the case when I started the show, yeah. But there was a couple of newspapers actually put in reviews of the show. There was the Telegraph and the Metro actually reviewed the show at one point. I thought, oh God, we're kind of reaching beyond the circle. So yeah, of all the shows, cool. That was meant to literally preach to the choir in the sense that I was trying to show the choir something that they hadn't previously thought about. It's expanding beyond the choir. But I think that still, even then, if you were listening to the show, I think it would be very hard to listen to the show, even an episode in its totality, but certainly several episodes to provide a kind of a context, a framework for what the show is. I think it'd be very hard to listen to the show and not get that the guest that's on there is holding a view that is outside of the mainstream, mm-hmm. That isn't well supported by evidence. And I think there are probably, I'd like to think there are few shows, if any, that a neutral listener who was completely had no experience at all in any of the conversation that we were having, you know, had no facts at all about the topic we're talking about. I don't think there's any shows that a listener in that position would come away from believing the guest was right and that I was wrong. I mean, I could be wrong on that, but I'd be very, very surprised. But yeah, the main audience overwhelmingly is the audience of people who already disagree with these views and will never, ever hear them. You know, the audience people who, for lots of great reasons, you know, they'll listen to skeptical podcasts. They've got a daily life that they go about. They've got a job and a family, and they don't have the time or the energy to go out and you know, look at blogs of alternative medicine yeah. and go see psychics and put themselves in those spaces. And that's not a criticism of them. But I think a level of exposure to those ideas is definitely useful. Especially if you're then going to go on and argue with your auntie over Thanksgiving dinner or with your friend from college on Facebook about a particular topic. If you've never heard the rhetoric that supports that topic, if you've never heard someone who's convinced that this idea is right tell you why they believe it's right, then you are kind of coming to that conversation cold. You've got no prep. So I like to think that the conversations I have are a way of understanding how some people could hold these views, because I'm not going to change the mind of the person that I'm talking to. I'd be very, very surprised if I've changed anyone's yeah. mind significantly. There's maybe one or two who were, like, I think Lee Piercy, the last episode, he clearly wanted to find the best way to discover truth. And maybe I'll have given him a few questions to ask himself along the way. And there's a couple of shows like that, but by and large, they come away unchanged, which again is why I'm not attacking them on every point, because my goal isn't to change their mind or to show them that all their facts individually are wrong and be the and win the conversation.
Yeah.
It's to demonstrate that we can have a conversation, we can listen to these point of views, and anybody who's listening who might be coming across these views and be potentially persuaded by them will hear me being a reasonable counter.
Okay, so you do want to provide... So there is still a difference then between just having them on to discuss their views. You do still want to provide some resistance... but it's just a question
of... it's polite resistance. I kind of describe it as being sort of intellectually rigorous. You know, polite but intellectually rigorous. If they're going to make a point that doesn't stand up, I'll explain to them why I think it doesn't stand up, or I'll offer them a counter-argument, I'll offer them counter-logic that will make them question that. But I'm not going to lose the amiability of the conversation.
Right, so you're only doing it insofar as it'll keep the conversation going, and you're not going to just stop them and sort of turn it into an inquisition and a challenge of that. You're just going to the best that you can keep them engaged, provide a little bit of resistance. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because I think in a lot of these cases, you know, you'll talk to, let's say you talk to someone who is a big believer in alternative medicine, and they think Big Pharma is this big, evil, shady thing who is intentionally keeping you ill and all these other things are being suppressed. If that's their belief, they see skeptics as the bad guy. We are the ones who are knowingly suppressing the thing that works, or unknowingly following the party line of Big Pharma. Now, with those people, they may never have a conversation with a skeptic. they'll just be told alternative medicine conversations or on blogs or in the various pseudoscientific fora that we don't frequent because of the way that the internet has become so split up and divided these days, that there are huge Facebook groups, even closed Facebook groups or even open Facebook groups that you haven't joined, that are having very, very detailed conversations about why cannabis oil cures cancer. And we aren't seeing that because we're not joining them. And they're not having it on blogs, so it doesn't appear in Google. So we're just not stumbling across those ideas. So they may never stumble across someone who's willing to talk to them and be skeptical.
The ultimate goal then sounds like it's still to be able to dismantle these arguments just at a later on point. Like, it sounds like you're not doing it on your podcast, but the listeners might, or they might, if they come across someone, you want them to be able to argue against these things more clearly. Is that right?
Yeah. Or debate those ideas. Yeah. To dismantle, it's given them the tools to dismantle.
Right.
The
so
ideas.
It's not it's that you of... don't believe in trying to dismantle these ideas. It's that that's just not the purpose of the show. Is that right?
Absolutely. And also, it's not always a good tactic, I think, from a tactical point of view. Like I say, you're talking to someone who's never spoken to a skeptic before, who thinks you're the bad guy. Mm-hmm. If you shout and rant and rave at them, you've confirmed that you're the bad guy. They aren't going to listen.
Well, hold on. Just right there to make sure we don't go down the wrong path. I would suggest the difference between shouting, ranting, and raving and merely disagreeing more forcefully or more persistently. You know, like it doesn't mean you have to be shouting, but you could be a Marsh doing a Be Reasonable where you try to argue every point politely. You know what I mean? So like the distinction I would want to look at, I guess.
I completely agree, but I think you'd also agree that the sliding scale of engagement with believers doesn't go from my Be Reasonable style to a style of Be Reasonable that argues every point. It goes way past that.
You're totally right. I'm just trying to look at, and again, I'm kind of selfishly trying to look at what I can learn, and that would be because I don't really shout at people, I don't think that I can remember. So I'm trying to think in terms of me, like, where do I want to fit my approach into this sliding scale as you've described it. But yeah, you're right. That's absolutely not, I don't mean to suggest that is the entire scale or anything.
Yeah. Well, I think when I have the conversation with these people, the worst case scenario in many of them, I would say, is that they go away saying, I just had a half an hour conversation with a skeptic and he seemed like an all right guy, actually. He wasn't the big, evil, ogreous, aggressive thing that he's been painted out to be, or that skeptics have been, that I've been led to believe skeptics are. It was actually quite a civil conversation, and maybe there are a few things in there that I'll be thinking about. That's kind of the best case in terms of the mind of the individual believer that I'm talking to. The average person listening, I think, will hear, if they are potentially persuadable to my guest's point of view, or even on the side of my guest's point of view, there's a level of determinism or doggedness that I think, even if I'm being utterly intellectually rigorous about it, is going to put people off. You know, there's that point. If someone gish gallops and you pick up every single point and you have to keep stopping them and say, sorry, could you stop there? Because I need to do this point next. Then even though what you're doing is absolutely right, the structure of that conversation is such that it's an interrupted social interaction that you're the one interrupting, and it's awkward to listen to, and you're the one being awkward. You're being awkward because the person who's saying all of that is not being consistent in their views and is using a rhetorical device that we all know is used to kind of just wash you with information that you can't all counter. But if you aren't familiar with the Gish Gallop, to hear someone break it down individually, it's very hard to do that in a way that you don't lose the neutral observer. So there's an element of the neutral observer in there too. And I guess that the last kind of thing that I'm trying to do, when you talk to these people, every time they've had a conversation in the past with someone who disagrees with them, it's basically gone the same way, largely, in many of these cases. You know, they'll hear the same counter arguments. They'll have the same points made to them. I mean, I interviewed a guy who was picketing outside of abortion clinics and handing out baby clothes to the women as they were going in, which is a horrible thing to be doing. But it would have been very easy to go in and tell him all the reasons that he's wrong and a bigot and a misogynist. And he'd have given me every single defense he's ever given to anybody who has called him a bigot and a misogynist. And we'd have just played out a conversation that he's had way more often than I have. His defenses go up. I'm not going to get into his mind in any kind of way. So instead, what I try and do is kind of, instead of saying, here's the reason you're wrong, it's more of a, I can't agree with you on this point because I can't get over this hurdle. How do you get past that detail? How do you get past this fact? How do you get past this hurdle? Could you help me over that? Because I'm trying to understand where you're coming from. And right. I want to kind of agree with you, but I don't understand how to get past this point. And sometimes if you do that, instead of kind of, I also, instead of kind of hitting the portcullis that they've put up, their defenses that's been there forever, they kind of open the gates and you get to wander in.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the episode I just did, I think last week, where I did a little bit of research. I'm not an expert or anything, but Haley and I did some research on the science of what actually persuades people. And what you're describing is a lot of what we found, which was finding a way around those initial defenses. But which, again, is odd because you're not trying to persuade the guy. Like, you're still walking this weird line of you're not really trying to persuade the guy, but you kind of are. But that's kind of what I've tried to identify. Well, I think I get
maybe
it.
Maybe I kind of, if I write my goals in order.
Sure.
The goal is, number one, showcase these beliefs that skeptics wouldn't otherwise hear so that skeptics are more armed with the arguments that are going to come across. Number two, demonstrate to the person that I'm talking to that skeptics aren't evil, horrible people. And then number three, third on the list, because it's probably the least achievable, is convince them or help them see for themselves that they're wrong. Not tell them that they're wrong, but help them see for themselves. And so sometimes it's that little thing of leading them around the maze of their own beliefs. And because peeking behind the curtain, the start of the conversation, I let them talk a lot more because it establishes a rapport and they feel like they can open up to me a little bit more. And then I start to introduce a few challenging questions a little bit, maybe the one third or the two third kind of area. So they have already had a long conversation with me by the time I start to really pick apart some of their beliefs. That's kind of the rough framework. Because if you do that, you're walking them around, you're walking with them around the maze of their beliefs. And sometimes you can get them to take a left turn that they've never taken before, and they're suddenly confronted with this wall that they didn't know was there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how they kind of realize that actually maybe this doesn't work. Maybe this isn't a consistent belief. And they probably will never tell me that they found that wall. They'll probably kind of, wheedle their way out of it with some intellectual sleight of hand. But maybe afterwards they'll be thinking, that resonated a little bit. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, when you put your goals in that order, I think that does make a lot more sense. So I would want to ask, though, how would you apply this? Now, you've got your show that has its goals and its guests. How would that change for you if you had a show like mine, maybe, where you're not having people on who everyone knows are crackpots, who everyone knows have alternative views? You're having people on who half the country agrees with, and it just so happens that a lot of the views associated with them are particularly horrible. And though my show won't be 50-50, there's no way it's 50-50 Trump and not Trump. There's a percentage, and there's a small percentage of Trump supporters who listen. I've heard from them. There's not many, but there's a small percentage. But there's also a large percentage of people who have all kinds of ideas about how the left is responsible for Trump and kind of deserves it. And there's a lot of, the point is, there's a lot of gray area where when I had someone like Dr. Price on, it's not as simple as we all know he's wrong. It's not quite that simple. And if not him, maybe the next person I have on, where if we're talking about a contentious political issue, would that change what we're doing? Would that change what you would want to do? Does the same approach work, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you. And would you keep things consistent, or would you want to change your strategy if you were talking to the people I'm describing?
Yeah, I'd like to think the same kind of approach would work. Because I think, I listened to the Price episode, and I thought it was a very fascinating discussion, because there were points where you were able to directly challenge on some things. And I think anybody who was listening would have heard that not all of Dr. Price's counters to your challenges were entirely consistent with one another, even. And I think that would have been apparent to a relatively casual listener. So I think if you come into that conversation, if anybody comes into that conversation vehemently believing everything that with exactly the same views as Dr. Price, or vehemently believing that Trump is a fantastic presidential person, then I doubt that that conversation would have changed it. But there are clearly plenty of people who are just in that middle ground, who are like, well, let's give him a chance. Maybe he's not so bad, in that kind of area. And I think by having Dr. Price on and showing some of his beliefs, and then saying, well, actually, what about this point? I mean, how can you be totally okay with the notion that Russia has intricate links into many elements of the Trump campaign, and that's totally fine?
You know, let me complicate it a little bit more. Something just occurred to me, and apologies that this will sound, I don't know how this will sound, but this is my current working theory on people like, for example, Milo Yiannopoulos, who I'm sure you're familiar with, right?
Many years ago when he was in the UK.
Okay, yeah. But I would say this is a worry I have. I'm going to reframe the question again. Apologies for that, but it's going to be the same question. But the added variable that I worry about is something I see happening in U.S. politics. I'll just speak for here. You know, I don't know what it's like over there, if it's similar or not, but there's a lot of dog whistling going on. Do you know what I mean by that? People do with Milo, what I've seen them do, it doesn't mean every person, but I've seen it a lot, is they want him speaking and they want him to be platformed because actually they agree with a lot of his racist ideas, and same goes with Trump. They agree with a lot of his build the wall, Mexicans are rapists. They agree with a lot of that, but they know that they can't say that, and they know that now they kind of can, but previously they've known that they've needed to keep these really egregious views kind of quiet. And that's, I think, a tough issue, because I think they've kind of gotten by saying, no, free speech, have everyone on, talk about it, whatever. And when really they want to support these racist, kind of xenophobic, sexist, when it comes to Milo, particularly anti-feminist views. Now, if you try to call them on any of them, they'll say, well, I don't agree with everything he says. I just, I think he should in general he makes some points that I like. And they don't like to get specific about it. But that's something I worry about, where if you offer, let's say, Milo a platform, and you're not fighting back against these points, I worry that, like if I had him on my show or something, I would worry about perpetuating that, because there are a lot of people that the dog whistle happens where they're like, oh, I kind of agree with some of this. And maybe the host agrees if he hasn't specifically fought him on it. You know, I think that's something when it comes to the fact that people want to hide some of their racist beliefs, and they want to use this tactic to be able to still support somebody who thinks the things they think. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. But what I would say, I think, is if I was to ever have Milo on the show, and actually about 4 years ago, I think, or 3 years ago, I did actually genuinely consider it. I was very close to kind of debunking him. And one of the reasons I didn't is because I didn't actually think he believed anything.
Yeah,
and I still
that's
don't
another,
think
yeah.
he believes anything. That's a real problem, is that he, and you know, you've done a couple of shows on Milo, and I think one of them you said you never want to talk about him again. But I think one of the problems you have with him is that he will say a whole range of things, and whichever one doesn't connect, or whichever one he's challenged on, he'll play the puppy dog eyes. Oh, yep. Did I say that? I'm only joking. Oh, it's
right,
just because
right.
of my,
exactly.
my British campness. I think he recently blamed on his British campness. Now, if you've met a lot of people in Britain, that is not a trait, that kind of say these
joke
these
about
horrendous
pedophilia
things.
All the time, or... That's not every
well,
British
we do,
person.
But oh, only okay. amongst friends. Yeah, certainly not in national news or anything like that. No, I think his views are. I would say his views are indefensible, but I don't think his views are his views.
You know,
that's kind
that's
of
a
the
great
problem.
Point.
He's willing to say anything. We've got exactly the same types of media figures here in people like Katie Hopkins, who's a correspondent, a columnist, who was a former reality show winner, who's saying things like, well, the Syrians who are drowning in the Mediterranean deserve to drown, and their cockroaches swarming here. And when she's called out on it, well, it's free speech.
Yeah.
Does she hold all those views, or is she paid to hold the worst possible view in order to get clicks to a newspaper and listeners to a radio show, you know? But yeah,
and so you would
you
say that
on,
kind of person, and it sounds like you did say that with Milo, not worth doing it with, not worth, it's kind of pointless because they don't really believe it. They're just,
certainly at the time, I maybe, had I been aware that he would take on the level of prominence in the US that he certainly could never have achieved in the UK. I think he did a couple of TV appearances in the UK and bombed because his shtick just did not fly.
Now, why
with,
is that? Explain
we
that to an ignorant American who's among the
I honestly
population
don't know.
Of, yeah. Go ahead.
It might have been just prevailing culture at the time. I mean, I don't think we are vastly different from you guys. So it might just have been that there wasn't this anti-social justice warrior kickback that you hear in the kind of the blogs and forums and spilling out on the streets and pulpits now. There wasn't so much of that 5-6 years ago, right. I don't think. It was maybe just kind of bubbling away. So, yeah, maybe that's it. I don't know that there's inherently anything different about us and you guys. Maybe there is, but it's not something I could really identify. But yeah, but I think if he was on the show, then I think, or if you had him in your show, I think you can still challenge the majority of what he's saying. But what you'll see when people debate someone like him, because he is able to throw out lots of different areas, they get distracted by each of those different areas.
Yeah.
So, and you saw that with, well, I've seen it with plenty of debates that he's been on. You know, he'll say one thing and someone will pick up on that and he'll just pick up one line of the counter argument and spin off into a totally different direction. And now the conversation's all about that direction now. And the original horrid thing was lost. So I think the way that you'd counteract someone like that is to keep pinning him back to the first point and not let him move on. And I think that's maybe how I would counter someone who I thought was disingenuously gish galloping, who was intentionally gish galloping.
And again, I know you did mention early on, you have had people on your show who morally you think, wow, what you're advocating is awful, which was something I was going to ask because the episodes I've heard, it's been more, you know, ghosts or it's been flat earth is questionable. I mean, that's you could argue, you know, that kind of attitude is harmful in some ways. And woo of any kind is going to be harmful in some ways. The risk of getting people to, you know, not trust science or not seek the right cures for things. But anyway, I was going to ask if you've ever had anyone on who morally was deeply questionable. Sounds like you have, and it sounds like your approach didn't change. But I wonder, would it change to get back to this question that I'm kind of asking? Is there a point where you would feel the need to have to, if you're not challenging everything, is there a point where you would feel the need to say, okay, what you're saying right there is wrong and harmful? Or do you never want to be that kind of moral judge on anybody on your show? You know, like, are you not concerned with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had a guy on who, what was his name? Mike Buchanan? No, I forget exactly his name. He was a guy who ran a very niche political party in the last general election in the UK called Justice for Men and Boys and the Women Who Love Them. It was the only overtly anti-feminist political party. And that was probably, I don't think he was the most morally objectionable because I've had AIDS denialists on and I've had anti-Semites on and I've had Jim Humble on and, you know, people with all sorts of 9/11 truthers from lots of different directions. So I've had some pretty nasty views on there. I'm not going to say nasty people necessarily, but nasty views that they're holding. But he was the one that I think that I was the most combative that I've been in conversation across the duration of the show, because I don't think he was making his point with any level of genuineness. And if you look through his manifesto, I mean, he had this ridiculous kind of manifesto up on his political party's page. And it would pick up on genuine issues, like if you're male, you're much more likely to be imprisoned than if you're female, which is true. And he would say, and this is because the feminists are out there trying to turn laws against us, and that's why they're intentionally trying to put men in jail. And say, no, that's not the reason. You had a good starting point that we maybe need to look at the kind of criminal justice system and why it disproportionately ends with men in prison. Compared to women, maybe that's something we need to look at as a broader societal thing of what influences the journey from.
Boy, you guys think you're imprisoning people? Don't even. Was it like 9 men and 3 women over there in prison compared to us, which is most of society?
At least you might have adequate number of prisons. Some of our prisons are running at 180% capacity at the moment. So they've got 180% of the number of people in there. We won't go into the prison thing. The prison thing is an area I look to go into soon.
You're never going to beat us in a who can imprison more people.
You guys are number one
contest,
in that. Yeah, that's absolutely
we're
true.
We're number one. USA. Oh, okay. Go on.
But I will say there are plenty of things I've totally fucked up about the UK prison system. And that's something I'm hoping to come to in future months when I'll be able to put something together in that area. But yeah, so I think he was making a lot of points that he didn't believe in, I don't think. Or he was picking up on things that were a starting point and going, well, this here, I can see this fact, and I can twist it to fit my agenda here. And that was something that I certainly don't let pass, I'd say, on the show. If I get the sense that someone is overtly, intentionally twisting a fact there to their end rather than genuinely believing it, then I think those take slightly different. They take slightly different handling, I think. Yeah, and it's not often that you get the sense that someone is, that you get a sniff of the fact that they are intentionally manipulating you here. But even then, I think sometimes I think I've got that sense. So now my job isn't necessarily to say you are intentionally manipulating me, but to offer a counter that anybody who is listening will recognize that's what I'm saying without me necessarily saying those words. I don't like to be explicit all the time. I like to trust that the audience is going to come with me. And yeah, maybe that's kind of hopelessly naive naively optimistic at times. But I think as a broader intellectual thing, I'd rather show than tell. You know, I'd rather the audience were given the tools and the information, and were able to hear how these two sides of this argument are playing out, and be able to see very clearly what's happening there.
It sounds like you trust your audience a lot, which is good. And it's certainly, but it's, I don't know, maybe I've just been too jaded by my Twitter interactions or something. You know, I don't trust people enough. And it's also because I think it may be the difference in subject matter. I mean, if I'm talking to somebody who believes in ghosts, like, yeah, I would trust my audience on a lot of that. I'm not going to worry about every single ghost thing that they're going to say. But I just wonder if it's a difference in the subject matter that I'm trying to argue. Or maybe I could learn from what you're doing in being a little more trusting of my audience. But I guess there's going to be a part of me morally when we're talking about some of these issues, especially when these people I'm arguing with, these Trump supporters, are in power right now. Like, this is who is in power. Mm-hmm. It's not like this is a fringe thing I can just ignore. It's not going to matter. Like, there's a tough part of me, like a tough part to ignore, I mean, that I want to be able to declare, like, this is what I believe. I think it's harmful, that some of these ideas. But I wonder if I'm wrong to worry about that so much, and that I would be better served. And maybe we would be better served if I took a softer approach that might have more of a chance of convincing people. So that's what I'm struggling over right now.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to say to that, I guess. And you're absolutely right that Trump supporters are in power or in the ascendancy in the US. But I'd argue the extreme Trump supporters aren't in power. Well, they're in power, but they're not in the majority.
I was going to say, Trump's in power.
Yeah, exactly. But I would say
Breitbart's in power right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say Trump isn't in power. Yeah. Putin's in power. Trump isn't in power. Yeah, leader of the free world, Angela Merkel these days, I think.
Yeah.
Certainly not Trump, by the looks of things.
I agree.
But I'd say of his supporters, the extreme wings of his supporters aren't in the majority. But the extreme wing, but if you were to tackle every Trump supporter like they were the extreme wing, or to use the kind of tactics and the kind of tone that you would use for the extreme wing, then the average Trump supporter will hear you with that level of anger and aggression, or kind of fortitude, and will say, well, he's behaving like that towards someone who must agree with me, because we kind of voted the same way. We must share some kind of things. So that's him essentially behaving that way towards me. I don't like that guy. I'm not listening. I think for me, the way that I tend to deal with those conversations, there's an analogy that comes up. I give a lot of talks around the country on sort of skeptical kind of issues. And people always say, how do I disagree with people? How do I converse with people I disagree with who I like in my family? How do I change their minds? And the analogy that I use is, you know, when you see in films, you know, there's an asteroid going to hit the Earth. And one of the ways that you see in films to stop that is to send up Bruce Willis to blow that asteroid up, meet it head on, big explosion. And then you've got all the little chunks of asteroid coming just as much towards the Earth. But now
I'm
spread
glad
over
you're saying that.
Area.
I was going to say that's not a good approach. Okay,
it's a terrible approach. Meeting things head on with that level of aggression, it can be a terrible approach. Whereas if you look at the best theories about how we'd avoid an asteroid collision now, is that you send up something with a reasonable amount of mass to hang around next to the asteroid
just
and slowly tug it away.
Yeah,
and slowly over a period of time, just gently move it away, and pretty soon you've altered the course of that asteroid.
Oh, what a great analogy.
That's the analogy I use in conversation, is just have those little bits.
Just kind of hang out with
nice,
them.
Keep on them. Exactly, yeah. Just be the person, especially stand when it's someone you actually like.
And, oh, no, yeah. This is not, I'm getting too literal. Sorry.
Yeah, but no, but when it's someone in your family, you know, be the person that they actually like. Who challenges some of these ideas, but not to a point where you break that relationship. Because once they aren't listening to you, they're not listening to you. You can't do anything at that point, I don't think.
I hate to say it, that I think you're probably totally right. Because I think that the biggest... When I think about views that I've changed, I don't know your history, but I was actually raised conservative, and I was raised in a very Republican Fox News household. And I wish I could say... I'm sorry to toot my own horn. If I were a less honest person, I would probably say, you know what? I saw the arguments. I saw that the data just didn't line up with conservative positions. I saw, but in reality, I worry and I wonder if what really changed me from a conservative to a liberal was hanging out with liberals. Was that my social circles when I went to college and the people that I consider smart and intelligent all happened to be liberal, and I started shifting and giving more credence to those views. And now in retrospect, I think it's justified. Like when I look back, I think, yeah, well, it's because of this, you know, economically this makes sense and this doesn't. I don't mean to say that it's all kind of relative at all, because I do think morally, when it comes to issues like gay marriage and issues like immigration, all these things that are, I do think there is a very clear right answer to those. But for some of these things, I really do worry that it's a matter of socially being around a different group of people. You just start to be able to trust that more. And I wonder if that is the best way to change someone's minds, is to just kind of be a friend to them more, you know?
Yeah, it's exposure to stuff. It's exposure to other ideas and exposure in a way that they the ideas, the scenarios, the situation you've been exposed to aren't scary, aggressive, angry. Yeah. You know, it's talking to the person who thinks that all skeptics want to murder babies in the name of Big Pharma, and not being someone who sounds remotely like that will change the perception, that when they go away and they think about what a skeptic is in my situation, they won't think that evil person. They'll have a picture of me in their mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some people, that's a good thing. For some people, it's not quite as good.
Hey, I think it's a great thing.
Similar. I mean, I grew up in the northeast of England, where the population's overwhelmingly white. You see nobody other than your own ethnicity growing up, and there are an awful lot of people grew up in my area incredibly racist because they've never met anybody who isn't from the same racial background as them. And what you see, and you know, I don't want to go too much into this now. Maybe we'll have a conversation in the future. But you saw this with the Brexit situation, that the majority, the huge numbers of the people who voted to leave the EU did so over immigration. The places that correlated most strongly with immigration being the number one reason to leave the EU correlated least strongly with there being immigrants. You know, you are more likely to want to leave the EU over immigration if you had not met an immigrant.
Yeah,
and vice versa. And you know, it's that exposure will teach you that the thing that you are scapegoating, the thing that you think is evil, the thing that you think is utterly counter and completely wrong and morally reprehensible, if you're not exposed to it in any way, it's very easy to paint it in such broad caricaturist terms. But when you actually have an interaction with the ideas you disagree with people that you disagree with, it's very hard to keep those caricatures unless you meet someone like Leo Rebello, who was the Indian naturopath who said horrendous things to me. And I think in that situation,
yeah, keep him
you can
out.
Listen to that show.
No, I'm just kidding.
But I mean, in that situation, you can listen to that show, and I don't think anybody's coming away from that show. I was very polite to him. He was incredibly aggressive to me, and I was therefore more polite to him, because he's losing the argument for himself. And he was astonished, I think, by the end. He went on this big, long comment rant in the comments to the show because he assumed that everybody would agree with me, because he thought he came out of the conversation winner because he made loads of arguments that I didn't counter. He made loads of statements and was you know, dominant in the conversation. And I was thinking, you carry on, mate, because you can be as dominant and as aggressive as you like, but this isn't a one-on-one. Everybody is not just listening to the content of what you're saying, which is utterly reprehensible in lots of areas, but the tone in which you're having this debate is also losing you this conversation. You might win this debate, but you've lost the chance of anybody agreeing with you. Lee Rebello, actually, incidentally, is something I always like to say about him. I used to follow him on Twitter for a bit afterwards because he just tweeted the most extraordinary things, absolutely bonkers things. I mean, he was incredibly like nasty in lots of ways. And there was my favorite tweet of all time was his. His Twitter background is three images: him meeting the Pope, him meeting the Dalai Lama, and him meeting Mother Teresa. You know, I disagree with each of those people from their ideology, but that's the situation, that's the company he saw himself in. So imagine that as the background to this tweet. Scientists have found a jellyfish that never grows old and will live forever. We should take a gene from that jellyfish and inject it into people. Not the Jews. Amazing. Just the best tweet of all time.
But, not the Jews. God. Wow. Oh, man. That is really...
sometimes when you're talking to someone with those kind of views, you don't need to challenge them. You just need to give them space to talk, and they'll challenge themselves with the tone and the content.
You're not worried about your audience agreeing with them, really. So it depends. If you're talking to somebody like, I don't know, Milo or a Trump supporter, somebody like that, I have to worry about that. I have to worry about the fact that there's a lot of people who aren't going to just quietly assume along with me, oh, that's an insane view. That's a racist view. That's a sexist view. But
it's all about the platform. It's all about the platform. I mean, I'm not, if I was the BBC, there's no way I'd be holding that conversation. And one of the things I do in my day job is actually, you know, the BBC Radio was having a conversation recently about the Andrew Wakefield film Vaxxed and how Curzon Cinema, that was going to screen it in London, pulled the screening. And in the end, it went ahead in another place. And they were meant to have a conversation about free speech and whether this film should have gone ahead. And instead, they got an anti-vax view on the radio. And she said on there that vaccines are danger for all these reasons, they've never been proven, and did a huge anti-vax rant. Now, as part of my day job working for the charity, we talk to the BBC, we talk to the editorial board of the BBC and say, this has to stop. You can't be having these conversations in this place where they aren't going to be challenged, or where if they are challenged, they aren't going to be challenged adequately. You're still giving that giving airtime and a level of prominence to such a fringe and completely disproven view. That isn't appropriate.
Yeah, and that's true. It isn't appropriate. And the faux 50-50 thing we do too in the media, people do, which is take an issue that's settled science and here's one person from one side, here's one person from the other side. I think that's pretty problematic as well. And it's something...
Exactly. So I don't want that conversation to go ahead, but I would have Andrew Wakefield on Be Reasonable in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Because I get to have him in the space where I know that... I was describing kind of one element of the show the other day is essentially like, you don't want smallpox out there in the population, but you kind of want it in a test tube somewhere for you to study. Hmm. And that's kind of what it is a little bit. Let's put these in a place that I think is safe for us to hear these views that aren't going to, that not, none of my listeners are going to come away from a conversation with someone like Wakefield thinking we shouldn't vaccinate their kids. So I'd have him on there in an absolute heartbeat. And I don't see a problem with that, but I'd also put him on there because it puts him in the context of a show where I've also interviewed people who believe that you don't need food and water to survive. You can live on sunlight alone. And another chap who is utterly lovely, who believed that in 15th century Dorset, which is a place in England, two green-skinned children from the future were accidentally beamed down to the 15th century Earth due to a temporal disturbance from the planet that they were being hybridized on. I'm quite happy for Wakefield to be on a show where that's the context he's in. Just I'm quite happy for a way for him to be on a cruise ship that's all about conspiracies.
Right. I mean, that I totally agree with that. That makes perfect sense. Well, I would throw one more wrench into the works here, which, and this may be particular again to the U.S., so apologies. Mm. But one thing I'm worried about with talking about these extreme or not so extreme now, sort of unfortunately mainstream right wing views, is I worry that the fact that we aren't required to vote here and the fact that there's so many people don't vote. And actually, is it the same over there? Because I thought Brexit, a lot of people didn't vote on it, or am I wrong?
Yeah, we don't have any requirements to vote. Right, and you look at someone like Nigel Farage, who was unofficially leading the Brexit campaign, and he's never been elected to Parliament because he's tried six times and failed. But he did get elected to European Parliament because nobody turns out. So there's like a 30% turnout, and it's so easy for fringe groups to push their agenda.
See, that's
that
a huge problem. I think it's Australia has mandatory voting, right? I'm pretty sure.
Issues.
Well, but hold on. Here's what I'm going to say. Because here's what I worry about. Now, we've talked about, I think a lot of this discussion has been based around, you know, tactics and what might actually change someone's mind. When we did the research, we looked at some of these studies, And I think you'll already know this just intuitively if you haven't researched it yourself, which you probably have, which is nobody changes their mind. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny percentage of people. And it's something that takes a really long time. If it ever happens, it doesn't happen in real time. And I wonder when the majority of untapped resources in terms of votes, in terms of getting things to move in the right direction and whatever, you know, whatever I view as the right direction in my country, since the majority of the untapped resources is going to be people who stayed home, people who didn't vote, who might already agree with me, is it then maybe wise, and this is something that I wish weren't true, but I think might be, is it more possibly more effective to try to drum up like an enthusiasm in whatever way I can to get people motivated to vote rather than try to convince someone on the other side who I have very, very little chance of convincing statistically, even if I do everything absolutely correctly, which I think you do on your show, even if I do a perfect Marsh impression and like challenge them just enough and do all that. That's what I worry about. Like maybe having someone on debating them, calling them out, getting indignant, doing all that crap that people do. Unfortunately, I wonder if that, when it comes to the political realm, is actually the more effective thing to do.
I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I would say from my experience with the stuff that I do, there are lots of people who listen to the show who told me that they were skeptical about lots of stuff, but not really that not that far, who listen to it and it helps them form their critical thinking. It hones their critical thinking to hear me have these conversations, to hear those conversations happen, to hear how to think how they would respond, to hear how I respond. And then they end up in conversations themselves, and the person they're talking to, they may be way better at convincing. So you're kind of arming an audience by hearing these views. I'd also say if you had even if you've got a particularly engaged audience, and let's say 70% of your listeners or 80% of your listeners vote, there's still that 20% that don't. And not a bad way of convincing them the merits of voting is to showcase the ideas that will be voting and that will win without opposition. To say, here is, you know, Richard Spencer saying all these utterly reprehensible ideas that he has, and they're going out to vote. They will be voting. And so this is what we're up against. Rather, so if you...
Oh my gosh, Richard Spencer, I should have asked you about that. We're not going to have time, but I mean, that's another problem area. When someone like Richard Spencer comes on, it's sort of that dog whistling thing a little bit. When he does interviews, he presents himself as the most reasonable person he can, and he sort of makes him look like something he isn't, and then he gains more followers, and then he saves his more egregious views for later, which is what I've seen. And that's a problem too, where I would wonder if you were going to have him on or something, would it be worthwhile trying to unearth views that he's maybe not even willing to be forthright about? Is that a consideration?
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to come armed with if someone like that.
So
you
do
have
your
to come
research.
With someone who's agreed. Yeah, absolutely. So when I had Jim Humble on, one of the things Jim Humble had said was if you look at how we try and practice around the world, they try and shut us down all the time. Miracle Mineral Supplement try and shut us down. So he said we set up as a church because if you look at the way the Catholic Church deals with paedophilia and the way it shuts down investigations into paedophilia, that's real power. That's what religion can do. And so that was the the quote of his that I brought up at about the two-thirds mark of the conversation, which marked a sea change in the way, if I remember, you know, memory's incredibly fallible, maybe I'm overstating it, but it marked a sea change in the way he was responding to me because I'd set up this conversation, this space, this rapport, and then I challenged him on a particularly terrible view of his. And I think his justification was, well, I'm just trying to remind people that the Catholic Church had this big paedophilia scandal. And I think that we can't stop reiterating that. I was just trying to bring that back to people's minds. It's like, bollocks, were you doing that? No one is going to believe that's the reason you compared setting up your own church to the Catholic Church's power to close down investigations into paedophilia. There's nobody who's going to believe that from either way. So I think you have to have a few, if you're talking to someone who is going to be that far over the line, then
and,
you have
and
to have
I
that
apologize.
Kind of sleep.
Substitute Richard Spencer for Tommy Robinson. That's actually who I meant. I totally just had a
Tommy
mix
Robinson,
up in
yeah.
my I meant Tommy Robinson. Richard Spencer is always pretty extreme in his interviews. Tommy Robinson presents a different version of himself in interviews.
He does.
And that's so substitute back in. I hope the
question still... Yeah, he also ducks out of interviews about 3 years ago when he agreed to be interviewed by me and didn't turn up.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I was totally fine to have... I'd like to debate someone who is vehemently racist. I weirdly enjoy that conversation.
But he's so frustrating because he says what... he has a weird quality that I've seen, in my opinion, where he does want to make the person he's talking to happy. Like he does, he seems to, in the interviews I've seen, I watched like four or five of them, so not a million, but he seems to want to be seen as reasonable to whoever's talking to. So he sort of adjusts his views a little bit, or not his views, but how he presents himself. And that could present a particular challenge for, but I think your answer was already adequate, which is you need to make sure you research and you know what this person believes. Because when you look at his Twitter feed, it's a totally different story. Like he'll tweet horrible, sexist, racist things, and then he'll go and put on a nice suit and look nice and look all presentable and polite in an interview and put a bit of a polite face on some views underneath that are really quite terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing about having the space of your own show is that you control the platform. So you don't have to control the detail of the conversation. You own the overall platform. Over time you've cultivated an audience, and they know where you're from. I'd imagine lots of your audience would know your response. Listening to that Robert Price interview, for example, I imagine a lot of your audience would know where you stood on some of those issues before you said anything.
That's true.
Don't think they would have genuinely come out of it going, "Huh, Thomas didn't question that bit, so he must agree with that bit." I don't think they would have done that. I think you establish your character through the drip feed narrative of several different shows that you don't need to justify your position every time. You can give them that extra bit of space. And sometimes
I worry about with somebody like that, the audience he brings to my show and what it sounds like to them, to people who aren't familiar with me. But I understand that. Well, I've kept you long already, but I guess, do you have any closing thoughts? I really do consider you an expert on this. What you're doing is really great work. I enjoy your show. Any advice for me going forward with this whole Trump supporter Price stuff? What do you think?
I guess what I would say is that the Trump supporters aren't one block. And it's very easy to write them off as one block. And that's kind of playing into the hands of the people who want to keep Trump in power is your extremists, the people who are part of the KKK who are supporting him, the people who are viciously racist and misogynist and all these things. They want to, and Nazis, literal Nazis, they want the safety in numbers. And if you write off everybody who disagrees with you in one block, then you're giving them that safety in numbers. So by challenging the extremes without lumping the middle in with them, you can maybe start to demonstrate to the middle-ish ground Trump voter who might have heard some stuff, might not have looked into everything, because elections are really complicated. And that was such a long, drawn-out election campaign that I could imagine you could easily get jaded and fatigued and switch off, and you've all sorts of things about access to information. So I think if you're able to demonstrate to the Trump voters, who actually are incredibly well-meaning, and I'm sure there are lots of them, that this is not the pony to have backed, and that this is the bed you're lying in, this is your fellow, these are your bedfellows, then at least you are maybe starting to get to a point where people will start to question the decisions they've made, where their support has lied. So not treating everyone who disagrees with you, I'm not saying you do this, but I imagine some people would, treat everyone who disagrees with you as one cohesive unit and write them off all in one go, or attack them with the level of viscera that you would save for the worst of their claims. The people who aren't holding the worst of those claims will feel that level of viscera is unjust, and they'll kind of be right because they don't deserve that side of it. So
at least they'll think they're right too. I mean they'll.
I think it would be the last little bit would be think the strategy of what you're trying to do, the long term goal that you're trying to accomplish, even in a conversation. That goal, put that goal first, and moment by moment, you might not need to do this challenge to achieve that goal. Short term of the point that you're making, you might not need to win that to win the overall goal that you're trying to achieve. So it's thinking. I don't want to sound Machiavellian, but thinking tactically or strategically about the way that you can do it in that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly there's some tactics to it. Yeah, well, Michael Marshall, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, Be Reasonable is the podcast. Is there anywhere else we should point people?
If you want to check out the stuff that I do for a living, the skeptical investigative activism stuff, you can go to goodthinkingsociety.org and see all the kind of work we're doing there. It's a charity, and we're kind of doing what we can on a very small charitable kind of space, but we're having some real effect. So yeah, that's the kind of the other work that I'm pretty proud of, really.
I will put that in the show notes. Absolutely. Check that out. Thank you for coming on. Really, really interesting discussion. Given me a lot to think about and apply going forward. And I think there's a lot of value in the approach of letting someone talk in some ways. I mean, I think as we've discussed, you know, our shows are a little different. I think I would adopt some sort of hybrid of that. I think it's always good to let someone talk to be able to refute their points better, to at least understand their points. And that's something that I think your show offers. And you have a very unique show. I love it, and I hope you'll keep on that schedule. are you gonna keep up with this monthly schedule?
Yes, yeah, I've got good. The next couple already in the bag, so I should be fine from here on in. I've got a renewed vigor for it as the world burns around my ears.
yeah, excellent. All right, thank you so much for coming on. Really, we'll talk Brexit later.
Yes, we definitely will. But yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Thomas. I've enjoyed this a lot.
All right. Yeah, once again, thanks to Marsh for coming on. Really interesting guy, really interesting show. And I mentioned it at the end, I do want to have him back to talk about Brexit. Totally different conversation, but something he can bring us up to speed on. Well, us Americans anyway. I'll just speak for myself. I'm sure everyone has kept up with it except me. But no, I haven't, because of the whole Trump thing. I haven't kept up as much with what's going on. Good updates that he could give us. Or maybe not so good. I don't know. It depends. But anyway, that'll be a later date. There's a lot to think about from this interview and listening to Be Reasonable. I think that our shows are trying to do different things, as I mentioned in the interview, but there's a lot to be learned from what Marsh is doing. And I think it really does come down to what I want to get out of it when I interview somebody like that. So I think it'll all kind of depend. It'll depend on the guest. But I look forward to the next time I'm able to utilize a lot of the tactics and techniques that Marsh talked about. So really great guest. I'm really glad he came on. All right. Well, that does it for today's show. I will see you guys on Thursday. Thank you so much to everyone who supports the show over at patreon.com/seriouspod. As I always say, very important to keep the show going, but I won't do another hard sell now or anything. Thanks so much. And I will see you on Thursday.